This is Mayo Clinic Radio, the only show that gives you the chance to ask your questions to Mayo Clinic experts. We'll take you beyond the headlines to explain what developments in medicine mean to you. Join the conversation by phone, Twitter, Facebook, or radio.mayoclinic.org. Now, with this week's program, here are your hosts, Dr. Tom Shives and Tracy McRae.
From the Mayo Clinic, Rochester, Minnesota campus, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Welcome, everyone, to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Well, Tracy, nice to see you.
Good to be here.
Nice to be able to see you.
That's right.
You have heard it said before that there are few things in this world more precious than your eyesight. And that's it's so true.
Mm-hmm.
You know, of all of the senses, that's probably the most important, or certainly one of the most important. And it's true that we really live in a visually oriented society these days. I mean, think about all the information you get every day from your phone, from your computer, from your
it's everywhere.
Well, despite how important it is, it's really easy to take your vision for granted, and we don't want our listeners to do that.
Not a bit. Today on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll meet two eye specialists, Dr. Sophie Bakri and Dr. Michael Marr. We'll tell you about the latest treatments for macular degeneration, which is the leading cause of blindness among American adults.
Unfortunately, we're living too long losing our eyesight.
Yeah. That's the number one problem. Everybody's getting older. We'll talk about cataracts, what they are, who gets them, the symptoms and risk factors, and when should you have your cataract removed?
You know, I don't know if we've ever really talked about cataract surgery, but it's incredible. It's amazing how they do that surgery and how quickly people recover.
Quickly.
We're going to hear all about it.
Plus, an update on common eye disease, a very common eye disease called glaucoma. Also, workplace safety and what you can help do to preserve your vision.
Yeah, nothing more.
Yeah.
Got to do that.
Save Your Vision Month. It's Workplace Eye Wellness Month. March is very busy.
Yep. If you could save your eyes, save your vision, and save your mind as you get older, it'd be perfect, wouldn't
it? Okay, it would, yes.
But first, you know, today is the final day of the 27th annual, I bet you never knew, the 27th annual National Eating Disorders Awareness Week.
Had no idea.
Yeah, and the theme of this year's National Eating Disorders Awareness Week is I Had No Idea.
Exactly.
That's right. Well, joining us by telephone is child and adolescent psychologist and eating disorders expert, Dr. Leslie Sim. Leslie, good morning. Thanks so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
So, Leslie, I Had No Idea refers to what?
Refers to, this is Eating Disorders Awareness Week, and that eating disorders is a very serious problem that I think we all underestimate in our society.
So,
it's not fully evident. I think we think of people with eating disorders as being very emaciated and you know, here we all are struggling with our weight. But what we don't realize is that people at all different weights and all different sizes can struggle with an eating disorder.
Hmm.
This is what you do day in and day out, isn't it? Mostly care for patients who have eating disorders?
Pretty much, all day.
And, you know, a lot of us think that eating disorders are almost exclusively seen among young adolescent girls, anorexia. But it's a lot more than that, isn't it? And it's other older individuals, and it's bulimia, and there's all sorts of different kinds of eating disorders, aren't there?
Oh, absolutely. We're finding this is a real equal opportunity illness. You know, I think the people think it's just teenage young girls who are very thin, but this is striking men, it's young boys, children, older adults. It's becoming such a big problem in our society. It's a pretty silent problem.
What kind of eating disorders do children have? Like, are you talking very small children, elementary age?
We're talking elementary age. I mean,
wow.
We're seeing 8-year-old girls going on diets these days. We're seeing kids who have anxiety about food and food making them fat. We have little kids saying they'd rather lose a limb than be fat.
Well, we're trying to be more aware of childhood obesity. So I guess it makes sense that part of that message might end up getting twisted a little bit for some of these kids when they're starting to hear, you know, you do need to be way less than more.
Yes. And, you know, kids want to be good. You know,
sure.
They want to do the right thing. And they hear messages like, you're going to be unhealthy and, you know, you're going to get diabetes and you're going to be really sick. And then they start to associate that with the foods they're eating, and they just start eliminating that stuff. And they can't really put the messages necessarily into context.
Sure.
They see it in a real extreme way.
You know, you sort of alluded to it, but well, what's the explanation for the marked increase in the number of people who have an eating disorder?
Well, it's hard to say, but we really have to take a look at our societal messages right now and what we're telling people with the media. Girls need to be perfect, and looking a certain way is a part of that to be successful. We need to look at, I think, our obesity, might want to say hysteria that we have right now, saying we, need to make sure that every child is not going to be at risk for obesity, because I think some kids take that message too far. So maybe we need to tailor our messages better, because it's certainly obesity. The epidemic is a problem, but we need to figure out how to better describe that message and tailor it to people.
One of the statistics that Dr. Shives gathered for talking with you was that 35% of normal dieters progress to pathological dieting. That was surprising to me.
Yes, in fact, there's a great study up at the University of Minnesota where they studied 2,000 adolescents, and they found one of the biggest predictors of developing an eating disorder was going on a diet. Hmm. And interestingly, one of the biggest predictors of becoming obese or gaining more weight over 5 years was going on a diet. So we think dieting is a big problem. It's not helpful. It typically doesn't work, and it can cause eating disorders and make people fatter.
And, Photoshop is a problem, too, isn't it? I mean, the women that you see on the covers of so many magazines actually don't really look that good, do they?
No, they really don't. They're cartoon characters, really. I mean, they're not real.
Yeah.
And so, I wish our kids could see it more, as that they really are, made by a computer.
What's being done to get the message about eating disorders out to the general public?
Well, National Eating Disorders Association is a wonderful organization that's doing a lot. They are having walks around the country. They have a wonderful website. They're doing a lot of advocacy to get that message out. But I don't think we're doing enough, and I don't know if our awareness campaigns are good, because we're still thinking that eating disorders are skinny girls that just want to look good, and that's just not the case.
So let's get a link to that website on our webpage.
Right.
So if people are interested, they can go there. And I guess the final question, Leslie, is when someone thinks that they may have an eating disorder, when should they go seek help? I would assume the earlier the better.
The earlier the better. I mean, really, we know that early intervention is the best chance of success. And you don't have to have physical health problems to get help. In fact, that's probably when it's too late. Once it starts to interfere with your life, with your focus, if your attention is not focused on the things you care about that give you value and meaning in your life, and instead is on what I'm going to eat for my next meal and whether I'm going to gain weight and how am I going to avoid going to Applebee's with my friends because there's food there,
right.
then there's an issue and they need to get help.
And what address can people find more information at?
I'm sorry, what address?
Yeah, is there a website?
A great website is Academy of Eating Disorders or the National Eating Disorders Association, which would have resources. And the Mayo Clinic also has resources for understanding eating disorders and how to seek treatment.
All right. We'll put both of those on our webpage.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Leslie Sim, psychologist and eating disorders expert. Great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me. Bye.
You bet. You know, Tracy, nationally, more than 20 million women and 10 million men suffer from a clinically significant eating disorder at some time in their life.
That's
incredible statistic.
And I really did have no idea, so I'm glad that we spoke with her.
Yep. We'll take a short break. Coming up, we'll talk with two eye specialists, Dr. Sophie Bakri and Dr. Michael Marr, plus, myth or matter of fact, only people with a family history develop glaucoma. Myth or matter of fact?
We'll get the answer coming up, and right after the news at the bottom of the hour, we'll take your questions for our eye experts at 507-282-1234. You can go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, or we already have a list of questions from tweeted in at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. We'll be back right after this.
Welcome back to Mayo Clinic Radio. Dr. Tom Shives along with Tracy McRae and this week's in-studio guest, Dr. Sophie Bakri. Dr. Bakri, welcome back. Good to have you.
Thank you, Dr. Shives.
And Dr. Michael Marr, first time on the program. Welcome.
Good morning, Tom.
Nice to have you. So, Sophie, you know, let's start with the back of the eye and move forward because you're the retina specialist and the retina is sort of like the film in the back of a camera and you treat people who have diseases of that part of the eye. And then we'll talk with Dr. Marr about cataract surgery and when you ought to have your cataract removed and what the symptoms are. So tell us about the retina. Why would someone become a retina specialist?
That's a great question. So the eye is a bit like a clock. It has the mechanics in the back, the battery, which I equate to being the retina, and then obviously you need a nice clean glass surface at the front, which is sort of the cornea. So every part of the eye is necessary, but the retina is certainly the processing unit that is attached to the brain. So it's really part of the brain, and a lot of the problems that relate to the retina, such as degeneration, are similar to types of degenerations that you can get in the brain as well.
And I suppose the one thing that everyone is concerned about now, because it has become so common, and it is related to the process of aging, and that is a condition called macular degeneration. And explain to us exactly what happens there and why it's so common.
So the macula is the center of the retina. It's the part that's responsible for very fine vision. And a degeneration is exactly that. It's something that is not normal and gets increasingly more common as you get older. Nobody quite knows why macular degeneration happens. And partly we know that it is genetic. It's also related to smoking, hypertension, patients who have, you know, too fatty foods or a sedentary lifestyle. These things all contribute. But why is it getting more common? I think it's because we're living longer.
Mm-hmm. So hypertension, high blood pressure, one of the risk factors for macular degeneration. And this is the symptoms. What does someone visualize or not visualize when they have macular degeneration? What's the first thing they notice?
So if that person is lucky enough to cover up one eye at a time, then they will notice symptoms very early. The symptoms generally include waviness, blurriness. You know, when you look at people's faces, they can tend to be extremely blurred. Now, of course, you may not have symptoms if the other eye is fine and if you're just checking your vision with both eyes open. So it is important for everybody to check one eye at a time.
And you said if you're lucky enough to be able to check one eye at a time, that is the key to going in and getting an eye exam, isn't it?
Absolutely. And that's when things are often discovered.
So when they come in to see you, you most of the time dilate people's pupils so that you can see in there a little better. But you can actually see the macula. That's the most sensitive part of the retina, right? And then what do you see?
So when we look in at eyes with macular degeneration, we see drusen, which are areas of pigment or sort of little rock-type lesions behind the retina. We can also see some lipids. We can see
fats,
right? We can see blood. We can see fluid leakage. And we can also see atrophy, which is retinal cells that have died. And that's the hallmark, really, of dry macular degeneration.
So there's two kinds, dry and wet. Can explain that for us?
So everybody starts off with the dry kind, and that's when you have these spots called drusen, which are an important diagnostic marker. And then the retinal cells can start to die in islands, so that's why we call that geographic atrophy. Now, at some point along the line, patients may or may not develop the wet kind. And the wet kind implies that there's a blood vessel growing from beneath the retina, breaking through the retina and oozing either blood or fluid or lipid or all.
Now, I know they both conditions are hard to treat, but one's a little easier to treat than the other.
So there are no really effective treatments for dry macular degeneration. Because the cells have died, we don't have therapies right now to replace those cells. With the wet macular degeneration, it's like treating overactive blood vessels. So we actually use drugs very similar to cancer drugs, which shrink and shrivel up those blood vessels.
Can you do that with a laser?
We can, but the outcomes aren't as good because laser is a destructive treatment, and we're hoping to just melt away the blood vessels with drugs.
Yeah,
I'm sure there are a lot of people. That are working on a treatment for dry macular degeneration. What's on the horizon? What's in the pipeline?
So there are hundreds of clinical trials going on. Obviously, at one extreme, there are stem cells that can be injected underneath the retina or inside the vitreous cavity, and those trials are going on for patients with really bad disease. There are also trials of neuroprotective agents, where unfortunately they're all by injection into the eye, sometimes monthly. But there's a lot of those type of things going on. There are some trials that have failed, for example, pills that have been tried or intravenous therapies. So really, that's the holy grail of macular degeneration treatment.
So, fair to say that right now, there's no good treatment for dry macular degeneration.
There are only vitamins which can slow down the progression by about 25%.
Particular vitamins?
So the age-related eye disease study, there was AREDS 1 and AREDS 2. We now have the results of AREDS 2. And they showed that a combination of five vitamins will help slow down the macular degeneration.
All right, we're going to ask you what those are in just a little bit. And we want to put them on our website, because that's interesting that there's a condition where truly vitamins help.
You got to eat more spinach, Tom. Yeah. That's the key. Carrots and spinach.
Popeye never
That's
ate it
right.
until he had to.
Speaking of medications, I have a myth or matter of fact for you. Taking aspirin increases your risk for macular degeneration. Is that a myth or a fact?
It's actually a myth. It was shown in one study, but counteracted by several other studies. And more recently, the analysis of the AREDS study showed that that wasn't true. So we'd advise all patients to continue to take aspirin for their heart disease.
All right. And another myth or matter of fact, everyone with macular degeneration goes blind. Is that a myth or a fact?
Absolutely not. And I would say the most important thing for patients with macular degeneration is to follow up very closely with their eye care provider. Early treatment, early diagnosis, that all helps. But even in the most severe cases, people will lose central vision but maintain the peripheral vision and the ability to see what's around them.
All right. And so what are those vitamins, so that we can get those on our list, the vitamins that people should be taking for healthy eyes?
So
for macular degeneration.
Yes.
And healthy eyes too?
No, just for patients diagnosed with macular degeneration.
Okay. And what would those be?
So it's the AREDS 2 concoction, which should be on all the labels, and that's vitamins A, C, E, zinc, and copper, and that may include lutein as well, which is good for the macula.
All right.
A, Z, E, zinc, and copper.
Got it. That's all easy.
Right. Thanks, Dr. Bakri. So Dr. Michael Marr, good to have you on the program. So you were telling me before the program that you are almost exclusively a cataract surgeon. So Dr. Bakri is at the back of the eye, and you're at the front. And I know that close to 500,000 Americans develop a cataract every year, and half of people between the ages of 65 and 75 have them, and 70% of people over the age of 75 have a cataract. So you're a busy guy. This cataract, clouding of the lens, right?
That's correct, Tom.
And the usual symptoms.
So typically a person with a cataract would complain of blurry vision.
Sort of like macular degeneration.
That's correct. And that can also be confusing, because blurry vision is a very nonspecific symptom. So a lot of things can potentially cause blurry vision. Oftentimes another early sign of cataracts is people complaining of glare or halos at night.
Oh, sure.
And when they come in to see you, is it pretty obvious they have a cataract?
It's obvious to us, and it's very easy to evaluate, because when we dilate the eye, so we make it so we can see behind the colored part of your eye, we can directly visualize the lens, and we can very easily tell how much cataract you have. The challenging thing is people with cataracts oftentimes have other problems with the eye. So to the extent that they have multiple problems like cataracts and macular degeneration, then the nature of one's vision loss can sometimes be hard to elucidate in terms of how much each one is contributing to one's individual problems.
We talked earlier in the hour, and with Dr. Bakri too, about one of the risks of developing macular degeneration is just getting older. The older you get, the more opportunity you have to get MD. Is it the same with cataracts, or does that have to do with age as much as macular degeneration does?
Absolutely. I would say everyone who lives long enough or gets enough birthdays is going to get cataracts, but there are things that can basically influence or modify at what age you'll get cataracts that are visually significant or affect the quality of your life.
When do you decide that it's the right time to take it out?
Ironically, when we look in someone's eyes, we can get a general feel for how bad the cataracts are, but you can take different people with the same level of cataract, and depending on how visually demanding one's lifestyle is, one person may choose to do or need to have cataract surgery earlier or later than someone else. So the critical factor is when it gets to the point where it really impairs one's activities, that's when we pull the trigger and consider doing cataract surgery.
And I've got a myth or matter of fact for you. Excessive sun exposure can cause cataracts. Is that a myth or a fact?
That's actually a fact, although it's something that's difficult to demonstrate.
But
we are under the impression that especially excessive ultraviolet light exposure has mainly negative consequences from the front part of the eye all the way to the back part of the eye.
So briefly describe for our listeners how neat this surgery is, how you do it.
Frankly, this is fun to talk about because we're very lucky to get to do this.
Hold on, two surgeons, here we go.
Okay. So a cataract basically is where the lens inside the middle of the eye is cloudy instead of clear. The front part of the eye, which is the cornea, which is the part of the eye that you put a contact lens on, for example, that part of the eye, we make a small incision. That incision is less than a third of a centimeter. A cataract, think of it like an M&M, where the chocolate is the cataract and the shell is actually a clear bag. We tear a circular opening in that bag. We usually use a fancy ultrasound device to vacuum the lens from the eye. And then we actually put a fancy acrylic or clear plastic lens implant in its place. And that lens implant is actually half or double the size of the incision. We actually fold it up like a taco and then put it in the eye and let it unfold in the eye.
How many of these do you do each week?
We do a lot of these. You know, most of the busy cataract surgeons do several hundred of these every year.
All right, take the old one out and put in a taco.
And now I'm hungry for M&M's for some reason.
You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio. Our guest eye specialist, Dr. Sophie Bakri and Dr. Michael Maher, coming up this week's Health and Medical News with Vivian Williams. And then your chance to join our program, 507-282-1234. Or go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org.
And lots of tweets at hashtag Mayo Clinic Radio. This is Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Hi, I'm Vivian Williams with headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. Chocolate lovers, listen up. Dark chocolate is good for you, and researchers have now figured out why. It seems dark chocolate helps restore flexibility to arteries, and it prevents white blood cells from sticking to the walls of blood vessels. Plus, they found increasing the amount of flavanols in the chocolate didn't change things. Now, flavanols have antioxidant properties and have been shown to be beneficial when it comes to things like heart disease. Well, the doctors say the effect that dark chocolate has is encouraging, not only because it allows us to indulge with less guilt, but also because it could lead the way to new therapies to get consistent, positive results. Now, this was published in the Phase B Journal. Well, here's encouraging news about multiple sclerosis. Researchers from Mayo Clinic say there's great promise for better treatment of the disease. There are 10 new therapies approved for use and other upcoming new treatments that may help repair the nervous system. Dr. Dean Wingerchuk, author of a paper in the journal Mayo Clinic Proceedings, says there's also advancement in tailoring treatment for each individual patient. Here's Dr. Wingerchuk.
The future looks very bright for multiple sclerosis therapeutics. Over the last 20 years, we now have 10 approved therapies for MS, and there's many more in the pipeline, including an increased focus on the unmet needs of secondary progressive and primary progressive multiple sclerosis. So we look forward to using combinations of therapies and ultimately towards a cure.
Here's some news about a disease called pulmonary hypertension. It causes increased blood pressure in the lungs and makes patients short of breath, exhausted, and eventually can cause heart failure and even death. New research from Yale School of Medicine sheds some light on the function of cells that are linked to the incurable disease. Until now, the behavior of these cells wasn't understood, and experts didn't have much to go on as far as how to prevent or reverse things. Now they have a better understanding of how these cells behave, and they can now work towards new therapies to target the cells and hopefully help patients. This was published in the journal Cell Reports. And now let's turn our attention to a fashion statement that doctors from Baylor College of Medicine say should be saved for special occasions: high heels. An expert there says higher heels place your ankle ligaments at a mechanical disadvantage, making them more prone to injuries such as ankle sprains. Plus, they can exacerbate bunions and increase your risk of hammer toes. So they recommend heels 2.5 inches or lower, and thicker heels are better than thinner ones because they are more stable. So sure, go ahead and wear those gorgeous shoes, but experts at Baylor say save them for special occasions. And that's a look at headlines from the Mayo Clinic News Network. I'm Vivian Williams. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network.
Welcome back. Information you want from specialists who know. We are with Dr. Sophie Bakri and Dr. Michael Marr. Both are eye specialists at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester. We are on air, online, and on iHeartRadio. If you want to listen live, go to KROCAM.com. And if you'd like to listen to previous programs, go to iHeartRadio.
We got you covered.
Type in Mayo Clinic Radio.
We've got our own channel on iHeart. It's wonderful.
Yep. Time for you to join our conversation. Question about your eyes, 507-282-1234. And two of our callers will receive a complimentary copy of the Mayo Clinic Guide to Better Vision, and the medical editor-in-chief is none other than Dr. Sophie Bakri, and she looks just like her picture.
It's like it was meant to be. Before we get to your calls and questions, I do have a minute of Mayo history for us, Tom. 2014 is an important year for Mayo Clinic. It's the 150th anniversary. So in this week's moment of history, we're going to recognize Mayo Aeromedical Unit that was created during World War II. As militarism advanced in Europe and Asia, it became clear that air power would play a dominant role in the war to come. And while aviation technology had advanced, human physiology had not. So a specialist in many fields, Mayo Clinic was uniquely positioned to assemble a multidisciplinary team which became known as the Mayo Aeromedical Unit. Charging the United States government, Tom, just $1 per year, the team, the team worked in top secrecy, developing a number of innovations that ensured adequate blood flow and oxygen delivery to keep air crews safe. Advancements from the aeromedical unit included the G-suit, the high-altitude oxygen mask, and the innovations had a widespread ripple effect, contributing to the success of open-heart surgery, commercial and military jet aviation, and the space program.
Pretty incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
150 years of service to mankind.
Oh, isn't that lovely? To learn more about Mayo Clinic's 150th anniversary, go to 150years.mayoclinic.org.
All right, our listeners are out there. The book is right here. The telephone number is 507-282-1234, and we'll start with some tweets, huh?
Oh, my gosh, we have so many of them. Let's see, one about wet macular degeneration, Dr. Bakri. Why is it that wet AMD will respond to some injectable meds but not others?
That's a great question. So if you look at the results of the clinical trials, they've shown that the three drugs are basically equivalent. One trial showed that A is equivalent to B. The other trial showed that B is equivalent to C. Therefore, we assume that all three are equivalent. Now, the trial results are, of course, an aggregate of thousands of patients, but we know that patients respond very individually. Certainly, the genetics can be very different. And at present, we don't have a good way to know if, let's say, it's 1% of the population or 5% of the population that respond preferentially to one drug or another, which patient's that going to be? That's where I think pharmacogenomics is going to become very important in the future.
Exactly.
All right, 507-282-1234. Question about macular degeneration, cataracts, glaucoma, anything to do with the eye.
Well, let's see, that cataracts and glaucoma, macular degeneration, all important. But Mike wants to know about floaters. He said, please talk about floaters in my eyes. They annoy the daylights out of me. They make you, the first time that ever happens when you're a kid, you think, whoa, I'm losing my eyesight. What's happening? What is a floater in your eye?
So when you're a baby, the vitreous jelly in your eye is very solid and very clear. But as you get older, floaters start to form as the jelly becomes more and more liquid. Now, of course, the floaters stay in the eye. There's no way to get rid of them. But most people, they start to get used to them. And for some reason or another, their brain just blocks out the floaters. Now, there are a few people that remain bothered by the floaters, and I have to say that's a very difficult thing to treat because, of course, we can always do surgery, go in, do a vitrectomy, take out the vitreous jelly, but really that's not indicated, and most patients should be able to get used to the floaters.
If he has so many floaters that, I mean, occasionally not a big deal, but if so many, could there be something else going on?
Occasionally there can be something else going on, so I think it's important not to assume that they're age-related floaters and to get checked out. But if they're age-related floaters, usually patients block them out, but in some patients it can take years.
All right, so there's jelly inside the eye, and it's called the vitreous humor?
Yes.
And what if you take that out, what doesn't the eye collapse, or do you have to put something back in?
Actually, we replace it with a salt solution. And with time, the eye actually regenerates its own salt solution and even replaces that. So,
all right, so it's not the worst thing in the world to take it out of there if floaters are a huge problem.
I say it's not the worst thing in the world, but as you know, Tom, you're a surgeon. All surgery carries risks, and there's certainly risks of retinal detachment and increasing cataracts. So we rarely, if ever, advise it.
All right.
Let's go to the phones. We have some questions. 507-282-1234. Mary is on the line. She wants to know about vitamins. Good morning, Mary.
Hi. The question I have is, I was told by my eye doctor, it was more than a year ago, that I probably taking an eye vitamin like Ocuvite or any of those type is probably a good thing. Even though I don't have macular degeneration, it's a kind of a good idea to take it anyway. And a friend of mine was told by her eye doctor at a different clinic that absolutely not to take it. So now I don't know.
You need a third opinion.
Yeah, I would like to have a third opinion.
Yeah, Dr. Marr.
Dr. Marr has it.
Hi, Mary. That's a great question. And frankly, everybody may be right, depending on what endpoint you look at. So, for example, for macular degeneration, the vitamin studies that Dr. Bakri was talking about, they actually demonstrated that people who take vitamins who don't yet have macular degeneration, the vitamin treatments won't help you prevent getting the dry macular degeneration. On the other hand, just in the last week, a very large study of male physicians came out where they basically randomized in a masked, placebo-controlled manner, giving male physicians either multivitamins or no multivitamins. And what they found is the ones who actually took multivitamins were about 10% less likely to develop significant cataracts.
So we're not talking about macular degeneration here. You're avoidance of cataracts.
Yeah. So the reality is, depending on how deep you drill into this and what you look at, you can come up with a different answer. So it may be, depending on how you look at it, everybody may be right.
Yeah. So split it in two and take half. And then everybody's happy.
Okay.
Thanks, Mary.
Hey, Mary, hang on the line. We'll send you the book.
Okay.
Mayo Clinic Guide to Better Vision. Thanks so much for the call.
All right. Hold on. And Audrey, our producer, will get your information. Helen is on the line with a question about fish oil, since we're talking about what we should take or not take. Good morning, Helen.
Good morning. I actually have two questions. The first is, does fish oil help prevent the progression of dry macular degeneration? And the second question is, what is the cause of macular degeneration in a younger person?
All right, Helen, great questions. And by the way, I think I have two of these books in my library.
Okay.
You know, they go untouched in an orthopedist library. So
okay.
These are virgin books, and we're going to send you one, Helen. You hang on the line after the answer.
Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
All right, fish oil for macular degeneration.
So contrary to popular myth, in the latest AREDS2 study, fish oil was not shown to reduce the risk of macular degeneration. However, there have been a lot of population-based studies on diet that showed that consuming oily fish can reduce the risk of macular degeneration. So I'd certainly consider adding oily fish to your diet.
And what if you just take a supplement?
That's not been shown to help.
Okay, just eat more fish.
Mm-hmm.
Very good.
All right, Helen, good question.
Wait,
hang the
other,
on the line.
And the other one she wanted to know was an early diagnosis of MD.
Oh, macular degeneration in younger people, right.
So macular degeneration in younger people, those under the age of 55, is a totally different beast. And whilst we call that in older patients age-related macular degeneration in younger people can be so many different things.
All right.
Okay, Helen, hope that helps.
Thanks a lot.
Hold
yes,
on the
welcome.
Line for that book, and we'll get that sent out to you. Jane has a question about surgery. Good morning, Jane. Welcome to the program.
Hi. I don't have a question. I'm a frequent eye surgery flyer.
Ah.
I was going to make a comment.
Okay.
I'm no longer a diabetic because I had a transplant of a pancreas kidney, so my diabetes is gone after...
Unbelievable.
44
wow.
years.
Unbelievable. Good for you.
Which is crazy. Cool. Yeah. But with the diabetes, and this is a warning to anybody who thinks diabetes is no big deal, I have had retinopathy. With the retinopathy, I had many, many laser treatments, laser burns.
Hang on 1 second, Jane. When she says retinopathy, what does she mean, Dr. Bakri?
Retinopathy is a broad term for a problem with the retina, but diabetic retinopathy is a serious condition that can involve bleeding vessels in the retina.
Okay, so you've had several surgeries for that, huh?
No, I had like 1,200 laser burns in one eye and 800 in another, and then from those, I ended up getting the vitrectomy surgery, what the doctor was just talking about, to remove the vitreous gel to get blood out of my eye that wouldn't drain. And then with that, I ended up getting cataracts from the eye being punctured during those surgeries when they have to go in to get the vitreous gel.
Sure.
So I had cataracts by the time I was 27. Then those were removed. I mean, so after that, I ended up getting secondary cataracts, which I had lasered out. And then from the cataracts, I got dry eyes. And with those, I had to have what's called stromal punctures, where they puncture your cornea to make holes in it, to make kind of a glue to tack down your cornea so it doesn't tear. And now I have another eye disease, and it's glaucoma.
And
so
that's...
now I'm worried about that, and they're talking about maybe doing a surgery for that because my pressures are going high. And I'm worried about getting macular degeneration when I get older. So
what is your overall message? It's take care of your diabetes?
I don't have a message. I'm just telling you what happened, and I'm telling people that have diabetes to take it seriously.
Yep. Keep your blood sugar under control if you have diabetes, and you can avoid most of the complications. Jane, you need a copy of the book. By the way, is there any eye surgery you haven't had?
Oh, yeah, I'm sure. I haven't had any makeup surgery.
Well, hold on the line, Jane.
I do have a question, though.
Okay. Okay.
My question is to the doctors, now I'm worried about this glaucoma that I have, and the glaucoma and the pressures have gone up, and now they're talking about doing a laser treatment. And if they do that to get the pressures down, do you think that'll hold?
All right, so that's what we're going to cover next, glaucoma. So hold on the line, all right, Jane? Okay, and so what about glaucoma? What is glaucoma, first of all, Dr. Marr?
So in general terms, basically everyone has a cable, which is the optic nerve that takes the information from the eye to the brain. That cable has 1.5 million fibers in it. Glaucoma is really a constellation of conditions where there's damage to that optic nerve, usually related to the pressure in the eye being too high.
Is that a family history? That was our myth or matter of fact. Is there a family history that goes with glaucoma?
So if you have a family member who has glaucoma, you definitely have a higher likelihood of developing glaucoma yourself. That having been said, if you take all people who have glaucoma, many of them will not have a family history. Glaucoma has been known as kind of the silent thief, and the reason is as those nerve fibers get damaged, it typically affects or makes you lose your peripheral vision first, which we don't tend to notice. So if you don't catch glaucoma through basically an eye exam early, it can be very difficult to detect until it gets to the point where it's significant. And by significant, I mean treatments for glaucoma can't restore vision that's already been lost. The purpose of treatments, which tend to be fairly effective, is to prevent further damage.
How do you
and that's
do that?
By reducing the, keeping the eye, the pressure under control.
Yeah, typically all the treatments focus on lowering the pressure in the eye, either by decreasing the production of fluid in the eye or increasing the outflow of fluid, which is what your caller may be hinting at in the context of laser or potential surgery treatments.
When should you have your eye pressure checked, and how do you do it?
So the American Academy of Ophthalmology have screening guidelines, which basically recommends every 1 or 2 year eye exams for people under the age of 18. Eye exams for healthy individuals can be stretched out even to as infrequently as once a decade during midlife. And as you get to be kind of more senior, then it's recommended to, again, switch back to every 1 or 2 year eye exams. There are many ways of checking the pressure in the eye. I think the important point of that, of how you check the pressure in the eye, is it's painless. And it's not something you can do on your own. And there's no symptom typically that you have if your pressure is elevated to a range where it's causing problems. So the only way to really know if you have an issue is through getting that eye exam.
And it's important to know if you have glaucoma or increased pressure within the eye, because if you don't treat it and you don't keep the pressure under control, serious complications.
Yeah, you basically will damage those fibers that take the information from the eye to the brain. If you damage enough of them, it can lead to blindness. Now, the flip side is over the last decades, the treatments for glaucoma have likely improved, and a large study was done by Arthur Sitt and colleagues here at the Mayo Clinic that basically showed over the last two generations, our treatments or the rate of blindness and vision loss in patients who have glaucoma has almost been halved.
Wow.
Incredible.
Well, the reason why we all got together today was to talk about Save Your Vision Month, which is March. So let's talk quickly about some of the ways that people can save their vision. Obviously, make sure that you're on top of the glaucoma. Nobody likes to get that puff of air in the eye, but you have to have that test done. What else?
Other things are simple things, actually. You know, there are plenty of activities, and it's common sense that one can do during sports-type activities or in the workplace environment where the eyes are potentially threatened either through splash injuries from chemicals or direct trauma. So wearing appropriate eye protection is very appropriate. And then finally, ultraviolet light protection.
Oh. Yeah.
All right. So wear sunglasses. And you want to make sure that, tell us about the specifics with regard to the kind of sunglasses you want to get.
Well, the critical thing is you need ultraviolet light protection. And ironically, you can have clear glasses you wear where the plastic actually has a UV coating. And then the flip side is there's some sunglasses that are darker tinted, meaning they filter out visible light, but actually don't have very good ultraviolet light protection. So it's important to pay attention from a labeling point of view that you have that UV protection.
UVA, UVB, it should say that on this. It should say that on the little sticker that you buy?
Correct. And you're looking for both.
Gotcha. All right. And Dr. Bakri, the important things to do to try to prevent macular degeneration?
Stay healthy. Eat lots of leafy green vegetables such as spinach and kale. Exercise. Definitely don't smoke. That's probably the biggest risk factor.
You know, doctors say that every single week, no matter what we're talking about. Don't smoke. Don't smoke. They say it all the time.
We haven't heard anybody that told somebody to smoke.
That's true. That's true.
All right. And I guess the word right now is that it's probably not worth taking vitamins to prevent macular degeneration, even if you have a family history.
I would agree with that because these vitamins are extremely high doses, and who knows what the very long-term effects are when you don't really need them.
But if you have macular degeneration, then these vitamins will help prevent progression?
Yes, and so I think it's important to have them at the advice of your ophthalmologist.
All right, and when it comes to cataract surgery, pretty easy to diagnose. The first symptom most people experience with cataracts are halos, and what else did you say?
Blurry vision and then glare or halos at night.
All right, and they come in, and the best part about this is they see you, you make the diagnosis, you put them on the surgical list, and it's an outpatient procedure, isn't it?
That's correct. It's almost unheard of to spend the night in the hospital for cataract surgery now.
And no more Coke bottle bottom glasses when you're done.
Correct.
All right. Dr. Michael Maher, thanks for being with us.
Thanks a lot. It's been a pleasure.
Dr. Sophia Bakri, always good to see you and have you on the program. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Tom.
All right. You're listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network, all about the eye. We've learned everything you need to know about the serious conditions of the eye and how to prevent them in the future. Dr. Bakri, Dr. Maher, thanks so much. Coming up, we'll tell you about next week's program. Stay with us. Welcome back. Next week on Mayo Clinic Radio, we'll talk about a widespread common problem called osteoporosis.
This is another problem when you get older. You have to deal with osteoporosis.
I know it. It isn't easy, is it?
It isn't.
Being a senior citizen. We'll talk with two Mayo Clinic experts, Dr. Ann Carnes and Dr. Sanjeev Kakkar. Osteoporosis. Osteo means bone. Porosis refers to the fact that the bones become porous. They become weak and thin and brittle, and that causes some 2 million fractures or contributes to 2 million fractures every year, usually around the hip, the wrist, or the spine.
I am only in my 40s, but I am almost scared to death of osteoporosis. I really am, because I don't know how much milk am I supposed to be drinking? How much calcium is too much? Can you get too much calcium? These are the things I need to know.
And we'll tell you next week whether or not it's worthwhile taking a supplement of calcium and vitamin D to prevent osteoporosis. One of the things we'll talk about. You know, it's best to find out if you have osteoporosis before you get any of the symptoms. We'll find out how you can do that and who's at risk for osteoporosis, including you.
Oh, good.
And we'll talk about prevention and treatment osteoporosis next week on Mayo Clinic Radio.
We hope you'll join us. For more information on topics discussed on this program, please listen to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org, where you can get a podcast of today's program, or go to iHeartRadio for all of our previous episodes as well.
You've been listening to Mayo Clinic Radio on the Mayo Clinic News Network. Our senior producer is Ron Petrovich, our associate producer and phone screener, Audrey Castletine, our technical director, Rapid Rich Peterson. Our theme music was written and performed by Chip Davis of Mannheim Steamroller. For Mayo Clinic Radio and Dr. Bakri and Dr. Marr, I'm Dr. Tom Shives.
And I'm Tracy McRae.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Any medical information conveyed during this program is not intended as a substitute for personal medical advice, and you should not take any action before consulting a healthcare professional. For more information, please go to our website, radio.mayoclinic.org. Please join us each week on this station for more of the medical information you want from Mayo Clinic specialists who know.